1881, he published A Systematic Approach to the Influence of the Recording Technology on the End Product and generated a general principle for source criticism for sound records. From 1981 to 85, he was supported by the Danish Research Council for the Humanities for an ongoing project termed Establishment of Objective Criteria for the Correct Replay of Historic Sound Recordings. Today, although Mr. Brack-Nannestad has made presentations in absentia before, he's here today from Denmark to speak on the Victor Talking Machine Company recording technology, 1904 to 1929, as reflected in the working agreements with the Gramophone Company, London Limited. Mr. Brack-Nannestad.
Thank you very much. I'm not nude, but I'll come back to that towards the end.
Right.
I found out that it would be nicer if I gave the credits first, so they won't be cut out if I accidentally should run over time. Yes, actually the title wasn't quite correct. It was The Working of the Agreements. I don't know whether working agreements is anything that really exists. Good. The fact that I can give up the present paper today owes thanks to the Danish Research Council for the Humanities, who paid for the research and traveling money, the EMI Music Archives, and not the least, the active interest and encouragement of Ask the Organization. Also, it gave perspective to talk to Ed Hutto, who is the only who has actually addressed Victor technology to any reasonable degree to date. Most everyone in this forum knows about the start of the Gramophone Company and that there were close ties to the Victor Talking Machine Company, at least from reading Aldridge's history, which was reproduced by Fagan and Moran in the encyclopedia. However, only since the publication of Dr. Geoffrey Jones' paper in Business History Review has the extent of cooperation and the closeness of the ties become public knowledge. Basically, all Gramophone Company gramophone, or as you would say, phonograph technology, prior to 1912, was Victor technology, since the Gramophone Company were only assembling and labeling Victor products. On the development side, the two companies shared the costs of the development laboratory, which was in Camden. The extent of co-involvement may be read from the wording of letters from Eldridge Johnson and Calvin Child in 1909 to the Gramophone Company, and I'm going to quote. The first is Eldridge Johnson. "It is certainly not worth the infliction of any ill humor from me, but you cannot afford to continue a contract of the kind you have with the Victor Company unless you avail yourselves of the full advantages of the same." Now, this is a businessman speaking. And in a discussion on the quality of Gramophone Company recordings of Tetrazzini, we have a positively old man. "They were the most disgraceful things that I ever saw come out of a matrix plant." That was Child to Dixon. "And we rather expected that these shells should be an example of your very best product, and if they are, instead of kicking, I send you my sincere sympathy." That was Child to Clark. Now, Dixon and Clark were joint managers of the Gramophone Company. And, of course, Johnson was president. Child was the recording laboratory manager at Victor. He changed his work a bit, and I'm not going too much into that. I would like to define recording technology, and I will use a broad definition which is actually in line with Eldridge Johnson's own ideas, so I feel I have support in putting the following into the definition. I would say manufacture of recording blanks, recording as such, matrixing, record material manufacture, and needles. Now that is, I don't want to get into gramophones because they were very bad in those days. That is pre-Maxfield and Harrison. Now we can get on with chronology. Up to now, I have not found any direct reference to Victor methods before 1905. However, in 1900, Eldridge Johnson filed patent applications for a recording machine and recording soundbox, and the odd remark, and the general development leaves me in no doubt that these were the actual, what I'm going to show now, the actual constructions used in the early years. I think I'd better take the whole pile with me. Uh-huh. Have you ever heard about static electricity? All right, we'll see if this one will cover it. Yes. Now, why is there a screen on it? Why is it so damn dotted?
It's a perforated screen for sound films.
Oh. Oh, all right. So you don't see the dots that I do. Okay, very good. It's meant for you. Now, this is the recording machine. It uses ball bearings. It uses a pivot up there to stabilize it. It has driving from one side and speed control from the other side. It has gearing driven by that one to cause traverse of the cutting thing which is put into that hole. And there is a prismatic, in fact, it's circular, but it works as a prismatic glide there. I'll show you the sound box, which is interesting. Well, before I show you the sound box, perhaps I should show you what it looks like from above. Not everyone is used to looking at engineering drawings. So you see, that is the top, seen from the top. That particular sleeve running along that cylinder is actually what caused, as far as I can judge the correspondence, what caused the machine to go out of use again. Because you drive here, and you have a narrow sleeve here, and you will wear, get a sticking there. And that gave many bad grooves for them, many problems with narrowness of grooves at points and so on. In particular, in the French recordings, where they used the Johnson machine for much too long. This is the sound box. You notice that it is a two knife edge style, one there, and it rests against a pivot there and there, two pins, and it's spring loaded, and it has this stylus bar. The stylus bar is connected that way into the diaphragm in there. I think we have to be very happy with the patent office, which requested that the draftsman should be of a very high quality, so that we can really see how it worked. Now, in 1905, we find instructions of matrix making in some correspondence. Matrix making, and I will summarize it in this transparency here. The interesting thing is that this is the actual process used by Victor and the Gramophone Company at the time. It meant having an original wax, you would brush it with copper and graphite powder in a certain mixture, electrodeposit copper. That was a thin shell you obtained. You backed it up, you soldered it to copper disc. I would say solder, but never mind. You degrease it and electrodeposit nickel in a thin layer. Don't polish, it says. Heat to maximum boiling point of water and wipe with a light oil of camphor. And then you do something interesting. You make an impression in a special mold, a special impression compound. While the compound is still warm, you separate them, you brush with graphite, you electrodeposit some copper on top of it, and you peel off and back up again, electrodeposit nickel to a heavier layer, polish that, and you mount it in your press, and you compress your record. So you will notice, as opposed to what I'm going to show next, which is the standard process used for records, which is pictorial rather, it was not... Oh, I see. We have a different standard in sizes. It is not an entirely electric method, electrochemical method of making a master. This is the later way, where you make electrodeposits every time you copy. You go from one side to the other. Yes?
He was reproducing the Berliner technique, which in order to make a matrix, they took the zinc, pressed it into a hard rubber one, and then grew another master copy on the hard rubber copy.
Right.
And Berliner was not particularly successful because the grooves tended to spread.
Well, there are many problems with this. They had many problems with their compound also, with the molding compound. It had to have the correct expansion rate. And if it didn't, it gave problems, as we shall see. Now, in May 1905, John C. English from Victor, the chemical laboratory, traveled to the European Gramophone Company locations and reported on the quality of the work. Even though the report is concerned with European work, he does mention a few Victor details as contrast, which are useful for us. He pointed out the necessity for good shaving and polishing of the wax blanks, and he suggested growing thick father shells rather than backing up as we saw in the earlier illustration. Johnson's recording machine is described as having been weight-driven. However, English has devised a spring motor attachment, which he says is now used by Victor. However, it is too heavy for traveling. English supports continuing research in making working mattresses, that is, stampers, in nickel direct from the original wax. So that was an idea that was around in 1905. In September 1905, Calvin Child writes to Theodor Birnbaum of the Gramophone Company with details as to orchestra and band recording. He describes the psychology of running an orchestra in a businesslike manner as an in-house orchestra. We obtain details of instrumentation, and we get details of a special instrument which was devised for talking machine work, the Helicon bass. This is a style of tuba going round the body, he says, and with the bell pointing directly forward. Child refers to the bass quality of Marsch Schlaf, played by Pryor's band, without any numbers though, as an example of the quality of this instrument. Victor indeed sees a tremendous advantage in having a permanent orchestra. The ideal situation from an historian's point of view is to have a report from an expert witness. This we have from the hand of Fred Geisberg in 1907 after a study tour of the Victor Recording Laboratory, and I shall quote at length. The recording room is 16 feet wide, 22 feet long, and 11.5 feet high. Ceiling and one side of pressed steel, the other two sides brick, and 5 windows. In summer weather, these windows are all open, even during recording. And I've made a comparative, from what I've found now, I've made a comparative drawing showing with a 6 foot man, 6 foot tall man, I can imagine such a person, in these recording rooms. The one which is described here is the one which has a blue lining, the Camden 1907 one. Now, what he says about the recording taking place itself, he says, in placing the men for orchestral accompaniments, the men are never crowded up against the horn, but loosely placed, this is from his report, loosely placed with ample room and at safe distances. A coupling is used that gives 2 horns for the orchestra, each 3 feet long by 10 inches at the opening. The horns are made of block tin with very few perforations for ventilating. Now, ventilating meant that if a gust of air came across it, he wouldn't blow the delicate diaphragm at the other end. They had to vent off a bit of the pressure generated. Military band required a different setup, which I have another figure of. I can sort of superimpose them, and it will help you to show that there is a difference in distribution. Now, this looks crowded, and we pull this one out, and we have the military band. It was definitely a multiple horn operation. Blanks used in the Victor laboratory are manufactured in a laboratory under the direction of Mr. English. The blanks used at present are, in my opinion, superior to anything we use here. He wrote the report in England. And are a great improvement on the old American blanks sent to our laboratory for tests. The present blanks used have the constituency of common washing soap, more or less spongy and without granular appearance, gives a smooth, glossy cut, free from grit, and takes on a high polish. Although these blanks do not seem to warp like the old American material, blanks that I have examined after sitting there for 3 or 4 weeks seemed perfectly flat. Neither in winter or summer is there any effort to heat or warm these plates, except that the room is kept at a normal temperature of 70 to 80 Fahrenheit. They have for the shaving 2 universal milling machines of the Brown and Sharp order. Sapphire knives are used, and it takes one man 15 minutes to turn out a perfect blank, obviously a bottleneck. And they are always having difficulty with the sapphire knives smearing. One part of recording that has always generated more interest than many of the other factors that are brought into view today is the mystique of the sound boxes. Here is what Fred Geisberg has to say. We'll get this one on top here. Right. The affections of the operators are equally divided between the old two knife-edge box with the strings and spring and a box that they call the R box, in which the stylus bar is mounted on two pivot points, one point of which is stationary, and the other point keeps pressing against the stylus by a spring to prevent a rattle. The operators alternate in making records and always take two records of each selection, sometimes three, using first the R box and then the two knife edge box, which they call D. They rarely make voice tests with their boxes and do very little fiddling or fooling or testing them to get them in shape. They seem to slap them up and trust to potluck. Well, this was 1907. Steel recording points are used as always. In preparing steel points, great care is taken to get sufficient clearance in the back, and they are rounded up almost like the small end of an egg. The operators set up their boxes and carefully prepare the point of each box in the morning before the first appointment. Each have two boxes, and they use these points for the whole day's work without further dissecting or retouching. And so long as the box is turning out good work, they will leave it set up for days and even weeks at a time. As for the point holding up as long as they do, from 15 to 20 records without retouching, in my opinion, is due to the soft recording material, which is free from grit. I'm not going to say much more about grit in the rest of it, but a lot of work went into filtering the wax they used to remove the grit. All the way through the 20s, they had devised different methods of doing that. Towards the end, they had really very silent waxes. Some of the inventions came by that time from the gramophone company. Anyway, as to the actual recording, Fred observed the following. Their method of recording is first to make a complete record of the selection to be made, which is reproduced on the recording machine sounding out into the artist's room where the band and artists all listen to it. Then, after the necessary changes have been made and where defects have been noticed, they make from 2 to 3 records of the selection. They usually start recording at 11 o'clock, stop at 1 o'clock, and begin again at 2:30. It might interest our operators to know how the Rigoletto Quartet was made. The regular accompaniment coupling was used for orchestra and a Y piece with two small vocal horns. Two singers sang in each horn. The Melba and Caruso duets were made in the same way, a singer in each horn. Well, this was his evidence. Also in 1907, the record manufacturing plant was studied by Mr. Hoyt, head of the function of the Gramophone Company. From his report, we take the figures for Victor record production shown on another transparency, which I hope I can find here. Yes. It is of interest to see these things because we can compare it with later information. We can see, Hoyt reported that matrix life in an automatic press, it was a semi-automatic hydraulic press really, was one half of the life in a manual press. On the other hand, it's interesting to see that in the automatic in 1911, we have a comparison of good records pressed and bad records pressed. I mean, he pressed 40 records, 10 inch, and you had 30 which were accepted, and 37 records pressed in the 12 inch, and 26 were accepted. The rest received, matrix life is an information I only have from 1919, so it's not really very relevant, not at this point. 1,000, you never got 1,000 out of the early presses. Now that we've been into most of the aspects that I defined and that contribute to a good record, we can better digest the development as it occurred the following years. In late summer of 1908, Fred's brother, Will Geisberg, who was to assume at the Gramophone Company the position corresponding to Calvin Childs, visited Camden for 3 weeks and he noted the following changes. A new recording room, which was larger. I'm hitting the microphone from time to time. You'll have to disregard that. All right. A new stationary gravity motor recording machine, which pleased him enormously, he says. And Victor now heated the re-recording blanks on a suggestion from the gramophone company to obtain a quieter record. However, Will did not think that a permanent orchestra was necessary in a metropolis like London, as opposed to Camden. Early 1909 reports small changes. Denison made an attachment for the pressing on the new recording machine, and Geisler another of the directors, reported that the last groove of Victor records have been deepened in order that the needle will not run across and scratch the label. The way that Victor did their last grooves has something to do with the kind of brake they intended to use on their replay machines, but I'll not go into that. In that case, I definitely find the Gramophone Company had the upper hand in a much simpler brake. There were discussions over the terminology for record material, and we find, to terminate the discussion, a summing up letter from Johnson of March 1909, in which he states that Victor, for the last 2 or 3 months, have used a better kind of material for Red Seal records. This material is different in handling and so requires investment in new equipment. However, a later letter in May mentions its use as scrap, that is to mix with virgin shellac mixture for making records. And so when you can mix it, it seems quite possible that it couldn't have been too different from the original material, but it was probably more quiet and more resistant. In the summer of 1909, problems that the Gramophone Company experienced with Victor type wax came to a head in that the experts refused to use it. The reason for the problems were not discovered until February 1911, even though innumerable experiments were performed both at Hayes and at Camden. On the other hand, Victor did not like the wax that the Gramophone Company had found in Germany, and which was actually used by almost every European recording company, having been made by a person called Sauerland. In May 1910, Alfred Clark and Fred Geisberg visited Camden for different reasons, and Clark reported interesting developments back to England. Victor finally has had success in nickel plating direct on the wax. They can now press 1,400 records without appreciable wear, and they obviously save the intervening steps. The recording machine has been fitted with a groove pitch changing attachment, and you can now get, if you want to, 5 minutes and 15 seconds of playing time on a 12-inch record. A triangular bamboo needle was demonstrated. It does not wear the record, and Victor buys the whole output of the makers. And this is from the patent. Actually, it's the corresponding German patent. You know all about the triangular bamboo needle, of course. It was very much used, called fiber, and used in England up through the 30s. Right. Emilio de Gorgoza was artistic consultant to Victor, and it is in an offhand remark in a letter to Child of June 1910 that he comments on the fact that the recording laboratory has had to move again, and he congratulates them. But I have not found other details or dimensions of a new 1910 recording room. You see nothing. In July 1910, we find the first indication of Victor recording speed in a brief note relating to a slight change in the style of a gramophone, and or rather the top deck of a gramophone. And I quote, "We are about to dispense with the figures 76 on our standard dial speed regulator, substituting in place thereof figures 78, notwithstanding the fact that the general speed at which our records are recorded is 76. We find that the best general reproduction is obtained by operating our machines at 78 revolutions per minute." Furthermore, now that is astounding. Furthermore, Denison is working on a dubbing method, and I quote, "As to the Tita Rufo records, which we are someday going to copy on 12-inch discs from the 10-inch, nothing has yet been accomplished because Mr. Denison has not yet fully completed the machine with which we intend to try to do this work." My reason for quoting snippets like this is obviously to let them ring a bell in your minds, since you would know infinitely more about Victor's record output than I do. Victor is an American company. Around this time, mid-1910, Victor were embarking on a large series of experiments with the groove profile in order to increase the life of a record. This was one of the cornerstones of Victor's philosophy as a record manufacturer. The first hint is given in a letter from Child, and I again quote, "We're going through a series of very extensive experiments just at the present time, we having found that the V-shaped point with the rounded end which he gave to you as a sample has a tendency to make the pressing material break out at the top of the record line if the groove becomes a little too deep, And we find that we are accomplishing better results for matrix making and for the wear of the records without losing anything in the recording by rounding this point off a little more. In early August 1910, Victor answered specific queries by the Gramophone Company in informing about the copper powder used on the wax, a second coat of graphite, and the good homogeneous copper deposit thus obtained for a father. The record material has been changed, and the new formula is to remain an executive secret. But now I break it. In fact, Joseph Sanders, an outside consultant, quote, does not know of this formula. In fact, we believe that Mr. Sanders still thinks that we are using what is known as Sanders' formula, and we do not propose to tell him otherwise. A surprising statement as to speeds is found in a circular letter to all Gramophone Company recording experts dated 10 August 1910, and I quote, this is a letter from Will Geisberg, who was head of all the experts. It has been decided both for the Victor Company and ourselves that the speed for our records should be 78 revolutions per minute. In future, please note and each morning time your recording machine before commencing to record and see that you are getting 78 revolutions per minute when the recording box is cutting on the wax. However, this was no permanent situation, as we shall see. A letter accompanying the bill for costs to be charged to the Gramophone Company for participating in the experimental department for the first half of 1910 allows one to calculate that the total costs of running this department for the whole of 1910 would amount to about $40,000, although the same letter says it will be an unprecedented amount, but I mean $40,000 in 1910. All right. In October 1910, Johnson concludes from 3 months' experiment that the groove shape is crucial to good wearing quality, and Victor now knows the profile needed. This he uses as an argument against the Gramophone Company, and he tries to convince them that Victor should in future make the new Tetrazzini recordings and other international talent. Also, Johnson is quite clearly afraid of the upcoming Edison disc record. Now, that was in 1910. He knew about it already by then. And he says the nickel-faced matrix is a definite success that is Child. 3,000 to 4,000 pressings have been obtained without discernible wear. So it must be said to be a production-wise a revolution. What had actually happened on the groove side was that Victor had discovered by accident, or rather by systematic looking for things, that Caruso's aria Recondita Armonia from Tosca, record number 87043, and others, made about the same time, that is early November 1909, stood up much better than other records. Photographs of groove shapes showed what to aim for. It was a rounded shape, a depth from 2.5 to 3 mils, and a width at the top from 5.5 to 6 mils. Victor were now able to get 100 to 150 reproductions consistently without signs of breaking down due to adopting this groove. In January 1911, Child tried to help a desperate Will Geisberg, who still had problems with Victor wax blanks. Among other advice, he says, and I quote, "Another point that we have found necessary for the handling of this material is to see that the stylus is hooked forward, say 20 to 25 degrees, as it is absolutely impossible to get results with a straight perpendicular cut or with a drag back of the center. Under these latter conditions, the stylus does not cut clean." This finally solved the Gramophone Company's problem. And in June 1911, the problems of sending good quality shells to Victor seemed to be resolved by the discovery that the duplicating or molding material that they used at Hayes shrank too much because of the gypsum content. They had realized that what Hanover was doing was much better. And the gypsum was used for changing the expansion rate. Bearing in mind that Victor was reported to use 78 RPM as from August 1910, it is surprising to note that Denison, while in London, in October 1911, claims that 76 is still used. The two companies would want a standard speed. And the Gramophone Company argues that they have 10 experts and so ought to be able to vote and decide for 78. Relating to ensuring a good quality original for the matrix work, Denison said that Victor make 2 perfect originals of each title. Furthermore, a pressing is made straight from the father And that has to last a minimum of 50 replays before further processing, that is, matrix work and pressing, is done. This, I judge, being a soft. Consists of making a soft, thin mother in copper, polish, nickel thinly, and to let a ballpoint sapphire stylus trace this copper mother, preferably at 3 RPM. Quote, this process will change the groove to uniform width. Now, this first report was accompanied by photographs of grooves before and after, and I would very much like to obtain both versions of the records in question. Let's see, haven't I made a note that I'm to show this? Yes. Now, they are 16994A and 88199, which we'll see in a moment, the second one. One interesting aspect is that it is the first time that Victor is doing without the molding compound and are making a metal mother. The inventor of this process was James Owen. Now, you see, this one is somebody called Burkhardt, which you know much better than I and pronounce him differently. The other one we can agree on internationally, that's Homer, Louise Homer. And we see the grooves before and after. And there is a definite change, and there is a note on it which was done at the gramophone company, and it says very bad shoulder. And it seems that they were using a chipped cutting stylus at Victor for making this recording. But they ran the ballpoint stylus through it, and they corrected the grooves. In the result was removing pinch effect at the same time, which, in my view, means that you should not use an elliptical stylus in these records. It's no use. You will just create more distortion. You now have a spherical embossing of the groove. Well, the inventor of this process was James Owen. Victor refined the process, obtained more experience, and during 1913 was able to communicate, quote, there is a little loss in volume, but this is made up for greatly by the improved surface and the ease with which the record can be pressed. Another reason for desiring a standardized groove was that Victor tried to develop a jewel or sapphire point for replay, which would prolong the life of the records. The stylus would hopefully be permanent, however, that did not work out. On the other hand, Owen had stumbled on a completely different proposition, the tungstone type needle. This is from the patent once again. There was a later patent on the manufacture. Victor dropped the jewel and concentrated on the tungstone. Getting the tungsten itself was a problem since the only supply seemed to be in Germany, and Johnson requested total secrecy on the whole thing. The prospect of having a standardized groove and a stylus that would fit in the groove was so positive that Johnson stated in June 1913, quote, we are going to try to have every record in our catalog standardized by the 1st of January next. The best description of the so-called ironing out process is found in a report that Sinclair Darby made out after having visited Victor in September 1913. The process is quite adapted for production by now, and we see that molding from the father is definitely no longer used in any matrix work. To give an impression of the size of Victor's matrix plants, these are Sinclair Darby's observed figures, 30 baths for originals, 206 baths for working matrices, that is stampers, and 70 baths for various processes, including thin mothers for ironing out. I mean, it's huge, this thing. In September 1914, Johnson reports yet another method for making usable old V-shaped groove recordings that do not even yield to the ironing out. The method is one of dubbing, but as opposed to previous attempts, this is really working. Johnson says, quote, the process we use does not give us absolutely perfect results. For instance, an expert can detect the difference between the transferred record and the original one when they are both new. And there is no doubt but that the original has the best of it. But if you play each record 25 times, the transferred record is clearly the best. We only transfer records, of course, that have the old V groove or some other groove that will not yield to the ironing out process. We do not transfer records that can easily be remade, that is, if the talent is accessible and not too expensive. Now, what is an original recording? That is the only comment I'm going to make to this. On the general matter of development, he says, and I quote, The Victor Company is now about to start on the broad question of improving our recording. Of course, I understand that you cannot go into experiments to the same extent as the Victor Company can. Your profits hardly warranted, but you can well afford... Well, they were close ties. You can well afford to keep your organization in shape so as to take advantage of any information that we may develop. The reason I consented to the rearrangement of the experimental expenses between the two companies was that I wanted the Victor Company to be free to go ahead and spend as much money as it pleased and not be held back by any possible limitations. Of course, most of our effort will be failures. The failures will cost you nothing, but you can certainly afford to take advantage of our successes. In October 1914, the Gramophone Company ordered a transferring machine, and it was delivered in August 1915. Harry Sui wrote the instructions. We can't have any details here, but I should mention that the original record is played on a turntable, floating on mercury, and that the actual transfer takes place in real time by means of a transfer bar, which is 0.3 millimeter in diameter and covered in a stiffening and vibration dampening compound. Introducing mass and stiffness will change the rumble spectrum, and I feel that this may account for some of the differences I found in some spectra of Patti's records. Now, I know very well that Patti never recorded for the Victor Company, but I have the strong feeling that what we can now get in Patti and what one could get in Catalogue 2 was quite definite dubbings. We see it down in particular there. This one is deviating from the general picture of all of them. And there are, this, I should say, is a combined rumble spectrum and noise distribution of a Patti record in silent grooves. It's another paper.
Yeah.
Anyway, it can be determined. In 1919, the Gramophone Company was taking up again after the war and had a lot of assistance from Victor. Some of it was in the form of questions and answers, in the traditional way one does this, and one gets a very good impression of Victor practices. The Gramophone Company now adapted Victor's method of using one serial number only and using superscript numerals for other takes. In March 1921, Raymond Sui went over to Hayes and helped to build up the recording department. We find a number of Victor practices described to members of the Technical Recording Committee. Among other things, Sui reported that Victor was still recording at 76 RPM while reproducing at 78, and it was actually decided that the Gramophone Company should change from 78 to 76. Well, Victor numbered each wax blank according to the mix used, by which means the quality could be checked and traced. The code letters for Gramophone Company operators were changed into another system in which Sui had BA for 10-inch and CA for 12-inch. And we know that, of course, Sui also went on tour in Europe and used these codes. All Victor wear testing is performed by means of tungstone needles, playing them 100 times. Breakdown before this requests groove correction. Some records have lasted 700 plays, although 350 is the average. In September 1923, now we're jumping a bit here, but I have little time, you have little time. In September 1923, Jay Jackson, who had been Sui's English assistant while at Hayes, went over to Victor to learn all the details. Among the most interesting are the following. Victor had used the DR method of recording since early 1921, and this consisted in using two diaphragms, push-pull driving a needle bar by means of a connecting wire. Horn connections were made so that the recording took place from each side simultaneously. The recording machine was situated in a special booth in the center of the recording room. The New York recording room had both new and old system installed. I would like to show a table of records, which was quoted, that was among those recorded by the DR method in early 1923. Now, there are interesting things. Mengelberg, Flonsali Quartet, Alfred Kortur, Olga Samarov. And of course, I mean, we all know that the early 1920s Victor recordings had a sound that made the transfer to electric give little surprise. The bass end was stronger, but that's about it. All right, these are obviously records that I would desire, which I will never find in Denmark. Anyway, we'll go on. Eccentric grooves were put in by an apparatus which is similar to the photograph that I'm going to show now. This is a machine which is at the Danish Technical Museum, and it is used for traveling purposes. The one at Victor was permanent. What it is that you have this this magnifier looking down onto what is happening. You mount the wax eccentrically and, of course, cut a circle. You would never cut an eccentric. Yes, simple, isn't it? Now, they would also introduce eccentric grooves on earlier recordings in which they had the metals, and that was done by rollers. They had a special set of rollers going down and embossing the eccentric groove for later use. Of course, chronologically, we're getting into the transfer to electric recording by Victor, and that is already quite well known. Instead, I shall briefly touch upon some of the mechanical matters that contribute to noise and wear. In December 25, Fenimore Johnson wrote the Gramophone Company and reported success in reducing noise by taking the Gramophone Company's suggestions relating to wax, that is, feeding information back again. One of the components in the mix was changed, and furthermore, Victor started cutting with a sapphire point, which was put at 7 degrees in a dragging position. It used to be 7 degrees in a hook position. When they changed, it is very difficult to say, but it is definitely measurable. In a letter from Harry Suey to Mr. Wicks, that is an internal letter at Victor, in April 1926, reports that owing to larger volume of electrical recordings, the groove has been made 1 mil wider at the top, so that it is now 1.5 mil radius, 2 mils deep and 7 mils wide. This change took place on 20 May 1925, and after that, the wear tests have been satisfactory. I'm going to end with a curious aside on electrical recording. In January 1925, Alfred Clark of the Gramophone Company faithfully reports to Victor that Western Electric have supplied the English Columbia Company with a complete outfit for recording. At the same time, the British Thomson Houston has approached the Gramophone Company for the use of the General Electric recording system, which was already licensed to Brunswick. In one sentence, Clark correctly identifies the principle which allowed me to find the patent. Of course, it's a photophone. But the interesting thing, and which nobody has told me, is that the photophone was actually working along the principle of Dayton C. Miller's. It was a pin, or either a pin or a string, attached to the diaphragm, which rocked the mirror. It wasn't a question of having a mirror on the diaphragm. It was actually magnifying the mechanical movement of the mirror. This we see here is a multi-microphone setup, of course. They all feed into the same cutting line. So it was a very advanced thing. Now, you could say, what is this has this to do with Victor? I mean, he was only reporting what was going on in England. Well, in October 1930, we find an internal memo in the Gramophone Company which says, and I quote, "Minute number 1537 was submitted, reporting that Victor records made according to the General Electric recording process were not subject to to ERPI royalty, and that these records was distinguishable by a marking of VE inside a diamond appearing on the record adjacent to the label. The Royalties Department to be informed on the above, with the object of segregating sales of such records, same to be omitted from the returns made to the ERPI. Now, ERPI is that part of Western Electric which dealt with recording, the Electrical Research Products Incorporated, and we know that General Electric owns 60% of RCA. However, I have not yet looked into the actual date of the contract with General Electric. Again, you have a much better chance of knowing approximate dates, since you will know at what time the diamond mark started appearing on Victor records." And this ends what I'm going to say, because, I mean, it is digging out into 3/4 of an hour, which was graciously given to me, something which fills volumes. Yes?
Do we know how they got rid of the swarf from the wax in these early days?
Ah, I have seen something about it, but I must confess that I have the idea that they were sometimes doing it by turning the cutting stylus slightly so that it would go off to one side over the recorded area.
In my time at Edinburgh, just after the war, sucked away by a...
Oh, yes. Yes, right. I don't know. The sucking...
When that started?
Oh, that would have started... started in the 20s with electrical recording, definitely. I know the stationary portable Hayes recording machine at Copenhagen had that one from the very beginning. Yes? Oh, I'm sorry. I am amplified and you're not.
That's a string voice galvanometer.
Yes, right. Yes. Ah, right. Okay. Which would have a very high resonance frequency. All right.
One more.
I'll take this gentleman there.
We all know that the first red seal that were imported from foreign samples, that was in 1902-1903, and then began the domestic recording program here in Camden and in New York. But on or about 1905 or 1906, there came in a terrific avalanche, especially in the operatic field, of La Scala Milan recordings, and those made also by in London, especially the Pepuzzinis. And all of these over the ocean recordings that came in had a very sort of a muddy background.
Warring.
As compared
a warring sound.
Yeah. As compared, especially in the bass, as compared with the evenness of the Victor bass, mm-hmm. domestic bass, what there was of it, of course. We've been wondering for years, what was the cause of this? Why the vast difference? Now, it certainly wasn't the material, because the Victor pressed the same stampers on their domestic as on the, with both kind of shells. With both shells were pressed on the same material. And your letter, so I'm wondering, that's one question. And the other is about the letter about Ted Mazzini. This obviously must have fallen into this category, because the Pepuzzini London records were transferred here from the Victor label in 92,000 series, the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first one.
Thank
and
you.
The vast majority, as soon as she came over here and appeared with Hammerstein, were cut out of the catalog in the 92,000 and put on the 88,000.
Mm-hmm.
All the 88,000 were domestically recorded, except for maybe one or two, like Romeo and Juliet Waltz, which was.
There is no such thing as the same stamper after 1913, I'm sure. There is no such thing as the original. It's been squeezed.
Well, let's say the same recording.
Session.
Yeah, same session. But the question in our minds is, why this terrible background, especially in the Yernani and the Pagliacci and the trumpet more sets and in the choral.